This is Spotlight Health on Aspen Public Radio, our six-part series partnering with the Aspen Ideas Festival and the Spotlight Health Conference. Each week, we bring you conversations with an exceptional mix of inspiring and provocative experts who dive into topics of global and domestic health.
Good afternoon, I'm Allison Bektesh, and this is Spotlight Health. Thanks for tuning in. There are all sorts of factors that influence an individual's health. Their genetics, for one, and their own commitment to diet and fitness. But even with those things going for you, there is no golden ticket to a long, healthy life. Humans need a healthy community. Funding for health education, access to medical care, even the availability of fresh produce can affect an entire culture. Spotlight Health co-producer Peggy Clark explains.
What's so interesting and fun about this track, and it kind of exemplifies what we try to do at Spotlight Health, is a healthy community is more than just the absence of illness. A healthy community is a place where there's access to physical exercise options, access to safe water, where there's a certain type of social cohesion and connectedness, obviously access to healthcare facilities. So we have some interesting people coming from across the U.S. that are working on this concept of creating more health in their communities, along with some interesting architects who will be talking about how the design of communities can lead to improved health outcomes.
You are listening to Spotlight Health 2018, Episode 4, Healthy Communities. Agnes Igoye is Uganda's Deputy National Coordinator for the Prevention of Trafficking in Persons and heads Uganda's Immigration Training Academy. She herself escaped traffickers at age 14 and has vowed to keep fighting against human exploitation of all kinds.
If you have a big mouth like I do, you talk about it. And so one thing I promised myself, you know, long ago, I promised myself that I'm just going to continue creating, you know, awareness about, you know, what was happening around the world about human trafficking.
Each individual story of human exploitation is in itself tragic. Combined, the trade can destroy entire communities through tearing up families, the spread of sexually transmitted diseases, and weakening the economy.
First of all, okay, leave alone, because for an individual, of course, sexual exploitation, whether it's labor exploitation, whatever it is, the turn, when you're talking about, medical HIV, AIDS, out of sexual exploitation, bodily injuries, trauma, the stress, the fear, physical and mental well-being, which needs to be considered whenever you meet these survivors. But also, traffickers reap a lot of money. You know, that money gets out of, the economy. It affects. So the money you should be spending on health and supporting your health and economy is money you're spending on dealing with transnational organized crimes and trying to curtail issues to do with security. And we're talking about traffickers who don't pay taxes. You know, the money is underground. They don't pay the taxes. Okay. And it brings a toll, you know, on families. Can you imagine if you have, victims and survivors, how much money do you need to spend on health? And you can imagine if the spread of HIV/AIDS, not just by infecting survivors, but also the traffickers themselves, how it spreads out those sexually transmitted diseases to the public. It doesn't even have boundaries. It's transnational organized crime. So you may think that, oh, that's something happening out there. But when a disease crosses borders, it affects different economies. And it even influences politics. Because if you have traffickers who are really connected and have the money, they'll run the politics because they want to control territory and make sure that they have smooth operations and rights. Just like how you see the drug cartels, you know, running all these drug cartels and taking up territories and fueling, you know, transnational organized crimes. Because remember, when you can channel money from trafficking, human trafficking, and channel it to buy drugs, and you can use the same victims to transport drugs. You can use the same money to channel into arms, because remember, that's an underground, that's dirty money. You don't have because if economies are tracking the money which goes to transnational crime, you need that money that you get illegally to be able to channel to other activities which are wrong and not acceptable in different economies. And you can imagine if you have survivors, they are healthy even when they are to give birth to other children. We've had survivors where they come from the airport and they are mentally disturbed. You take them straight to mental hospitals. They can't even talk, and you can't even get an interview from them. So we have people like that. It's all intertwined, you know, within. So health is a very, very huge aspect. Even on rehabilitation, it's huge because every survivor of trafficking has to go through some kind of health problems and has to deal with the trauma, the stress, transmitted, you know, sexually transmitted diseases, name it.
As you're telling these stories, in my mind, the traffickers are just pure evil. They're capitalizing on other people's lives and it's all for the money kind of thing. Is there more to that story? Are there traffickers themselves who are victims, or are people forced into helping traffickers?
That's a very good question. I want also to bring to your attention that survivors can also be turned into traffickers, and this is how they do it. For example, you are lured with the promises of a good job, for example, abroad. That's a common one. And then when you get there, they tell you, listen, the kind of job we want you to do, it turns out to be prostitution. And you say, no, I can't. That's not what brought me here. And they have all these control mechanisms. And then they'll tell you, okay, if you're not going to go through it, pay our money because you paid for your transportation. They've withdrawn your passport. You're in a country maybe where you don't even speak the language. The first sexual experiences are usually the rape. I had a survivor. She was raped by three men high on drugs in the Middle East. And then they have you over the years. And after some time, they realize that you're not bringing for them more value for money because you're getting older, or they don't want you anymore. And sometimes you're even unwell because, you know, having multiple sexual partners and going through rape all the time. And so they give you a condition that you have to recruit other people, you know, to win your freedom. So I've met survivors like that. There's actually one girl who was recruited by a person she grew up with in the neighborhood, and that person needed to get out, but she was told to recruit other people. And so the easiest people to recruit are people known to you because they trust you more. And she started posting pictures on social media looking like she was in an office and dressed up, and managed to convince this friend back in Uganda that she could get her a job. And then she manages to lure her and coaching her through the process. And when she got there, she met somebody else at the airport who actually wanted to sexually exploit her. And then she started seeing the signs, and then she said, no, this is not what brought me. The next morning, they took her to a brothel where her friend came. Shortly afterwards, the friend disappears and she never saw the friend again, and leaving her there in the hands of strangers who now, start exploiting her in that way. So the person, when I spoke to her, she said, you know, she forgives her friend because she knows her friend was also lured to it and she needed to get out. So they use survivors, you know, to recruit other people. And traffickers, they cut across society. You may be surprised. Even the people you think are more respected in society, you may find that they are into it because there's money to be made. Look at people who are involved in the drug trade. It can be a very respected politician. So we have to be very careful to see whom do we categorize, whom do you think a trafficker is. They live among us, that's for sure.
So what are some of the solutions? Let's start with Ugandan laws that have changed, or is there a model law or policy that you're seeing somewhere worldwide that really got it right?
It's really a combination of issues. First, for example, Uganda, we know that prevention is key because when you prevent something, it doesn't happen. So it's really a combination of issues. When you create that awareness, you have to create jobs, you know, for people, because usually with the youth, the catchword is that you need a job, okay? And then you are lured because you are unemployed. And then if something has happened, you know, to somebody, you have to protect them. It comes to survivors. That's why I built a center for survivors of human trafficking, because here's the thing. Survivors need our support. You need shelter, you know, housing and medical, because until those needs are met, you can't expect a survivor to go to court and testify, for example, if they are afraid. You lose cases. Globally, cases are lost in court because people are not taking care of survivors. A survivor needs to be taken care of to be able to go through the court process. And it's not just a moral thing to do and to take care of people, but it is so important. Survivors can give us the trends. They know where we can get traffickers. They know the tactics they use. And the more we work closely with them, you know, the better. And then there's the prosecution bit. You have to show people that some people are paying a price for the bad things they are doing. If that is not there, then people laugh all the way to the bank, but it can be a deterrent. So it depends on what laws do we have, what penalties do we have to actually make sure that people pay, and it's a deterrent, you know, for you to be involved in such an activity. And then we have to partner through law enforcement in country, immigration, police, social workers, doctors. You have to work hand in hand and share information, and then across borders. You cannot sit in America, for example, and think that, oh, okay, it's happening out there. Come on. It's in your neighborhood and, you know, doorsteps. And now more and more people are realizing that what is happening to one country on trafficking affects other countries, affects the economies where countries live. So it is all our responsibilities. And the good news is that we can all do something about it. You start by finding out what this trafficking is. If you know how to sing, you sing about it. If you can write, you write about it. If you see something happen in your neighborhood, you talk to law enforcement. Like I always say, you know, if I have a big mouth like I do, you talk about it. If you have money and you can support organizations, you know, within, you know, your community or what to support. So everybody has something they can do. It's really about, you know, knowing what it is and having knowledge around it and tapping into your gifting, your talent to be able to support and make a difference in this movement.
Agnes Igoye, she is the head of Uganda's Immigration Training Academy. Agnes, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You are listening to Spotlight Health on Aspen Public Radio. In this 6-part series, we take a look inside the individual tracks of the Spotlight Health Conference from the Aspen Institute, June 21st through 24th. Today, we hear from featured speakers from the track Healthy Communities. Back with more in a moment. Growing up, Davida Davison lived in a town of nearly 1.5 million people. These days, the population of her community is only about 600,000. The thing is, in both cases, we're talking about Detroit.
This is kind of like where my story begins. And that is because even though my mother and father left the South to the North, Detroit specifically, they still brought with them that tradition around how they ate in the South.
As executive director of Food Lab Detroit, Davison has seen that improving community health means also looking at systemic societal injustices and playing to the unique strengths of a place that turns it into a community. Can we talk about the term food justice and what that means?
It's a very broad term, right? People kind of use that as an umbrella term. But really what food justice means, it's about equity. It's about the fact that folks should have not only access to, but also a right for healthy, clean, fresh, nutritional food, irregardless of one's economic status. But I want to be very, very clear around this justice. It's because when we look at food and food from a systemic standpoint, in terms of how food is grown, right? How food is produced, how food is distributed. In many cases, unfortunately, I think that we don't do a very good job in this country of really understanding, Allison, the price of food. And the reason why we don't have an idea of how much food really costs is because the labor that goes into not only growing the food and harvesting the food, but manufacturing the food and processing the food, and now even serving the food at restaurants, that labor is usually exploited by Black and brown bodies.
You have some terms like you're hoping for a new food economy, triple bottom line, food businesses. What is Food Lab Detroit doing to address some of the issues you just brought up?
There are folks who describe Detroit and cities like Detroit as what they call food deserts, right? But when you are in organizing and when you are working in food justice, we don't like to call our communities and neighborhoods food deserts, because just the pure word desert implies that it's barren, that nothing can grow there. So we like to call it food apartheid. And that's where Food Lab comes in, is because it's important that when we think about these critical components around health and the lack of healthy food in neighborhoods that are predominantly occupied by folks of color, is that we also know that these neighborhoods are occupied by folks who are also low resource, and some folks too who may be living at or below poverty. So we began to think, how can we tackle two birds in one stone, right? How can we begin to address the lack of healthy food, but also begin to address the lack of businesses that are owned by folks in the community and neighborhood? So what we thought is that if we created an organization like Food Lab Detroit, which would be at the intersection of food and entrepreneurship, then is it possible that if we could help Detroiters start, launch, operate sustainably, and scale what we call triple bottom line food businesses, is it possible we could also solve the lack of healthy food in these communities as well?
Have you gotten to know any of these entrepreneurs?
Of course, of course, of course. One of the founding members of Food Lab Detroit is a partnership. They not only are business partners, but they're partners in life, is Erica and Kirsten Boyd. And when Erica and Kirsten started their business, they started it because they were directly impacted by what happens when you don't have access to healthy food in your community and neighborhood. And what they did was they came up with a concept that was called Detroit Vegan Soul. So they took all the familiarities of soul food, things that folks were used to eating, and made it all plant-based. And fast forward 3 years when they opened up their very first location. And when they opened the doors, it was a line all the way down the street and around the corner. Folks were highly anticipating their opening. So here it is, a business that went from selling lunches out of a brown paper bag to now helping to transform, reshape, revitalize a community using food as a conduit to do that. And I'll never forget this day. And I was in the kitchen with one of our entrepreneurs. Her name was Miss Renee. I remember being in the kitchen with her. It was myself, it was Miss Renee, and it was the inspector. And she passed her exam. She passed her inspection. She was so excited. She was so excited. I might even seen tears. And I said to her, I said, oh, Miss Renee, I'm so happy for you. And I'm so happy that myself and Food Lab Detroit could be a part of this journey for you. And we're so pleased that you're a part of our organization. And we're so happy that we were able to assist you in incubating your business. Can't wait to see, you know, where you're going to take this. And she looked at me as only an elder could. And she was a middle-aged African-American woman. And she said to me, she turned around, she looked at me, and she said, Devita, stop saying that you helped me incubate my business. And I thought to myself, uh-oh, I said something wrong. I've offended Miss Renee. And she said, I want you to stop saying that, baby, because you didn't help me incubate my business. You helped me to incubate my dream. And that story is just as powerful as the Kirsten and Erica story, because here it was, a single woman, middle-aged African-American, who had started a business, and the reason why she had started this business now is so she could get supplemental income. In addition to her full-time job, she also wanted supplemental income doing something that she absolutely loved, so she could put that money aside to help her son, who was going to be the first person in her family, go to college.
Is there something specific or unique about Detroit that makes this model work?
Oh, God, it is. And people have come to Detroit to study Detroit. People, for us that, you know, work in this food justice movement or who work in food entrepreneurship, have come to Detroit and say, oh, can you come to my city? Can you come to my town? Can you tell us how to do it? Like, we've got underutilized dormant kitchens as well. Maybe we can do what you guys are doing. And here's the thing, is that Detroit and the work that is being done in Detroit, not only is it so place-based, but it is so much collaboration. There's an ecosystem here.
Devita Davidson, Executive Director of Food Lab Detroit, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Allison.
You're listening to Spotlight Health on Aspen Public Radio, a partnership with the Aspen Ideas Festival and the Spotlight Health Conference, which celebrates its fifth year this summer. Our six-week series takes you inside the discussions and discoveries leading up to the conference. We'll be right back. Dan Buettner is a National Geographic Fellow, journalist, and New York Times bestselling author of The Blue Zones, Lessons for Living Longer from the People Who've Lived the Longest. His newest book essentially explores the blue zones of happiness. Turns out, the elements that lead to a long life look a lot like the ones that lead to a happy one.
Where people live a long time, they eat mostly a plant-based diet. They know their sense of purpose and they put it to work every day. They have strong social networks of other healthy people. And they live in environments where the healthy choice is the easy choice. And I would argue that last one is the most important facet of living a long time.
So are you seeing that living long and being healthy do go hand in hand?
They absolutely go hand in hand. In fact, we find in these blue zone areas, people who are making it to 200 actually have shorter telomeres than they should have given their age. That means biologically speaking, they're about a decade younger than somebody of equivalent age, say, living in the United States.
That's astounding.
Well, it just shows that there's things we can do to lengthen our lives and to feel better today.
Can any town become one of these blue zones? What needs to be in place for anywhere in the world to have these attributes?
Well, there are these blue zones areas, which are the five founder places. But right now, I've been working to manufacture blue zone certified cities. And we work with insurance companies. And the only cities that we accept are cities where the leaders work well together, number one. And number two, those leaders understand what we do and sign a pledge saying that they're signed up for the next 3 to 5 years to really make it an effort to reshape the environment they live in. And that's not every American city.
What are some of those greatest barriers? Is it that leadership wants to do that? It's just not possible to pull off? Or is there some resistance to even committing to that?
First of all, it's a publicly supported, privately funded efforts. So the city manager, the mayor, the city council, the chamber of commerce, the big CEOs, the superintendent of schools, and usually the local healthcare system all have to be on the same page, and you don't always get that. Secondly, a lot of the things we ask them to do is to change their policies to favor fruits and vegetables over junk food, favor the pedestrian over the motorist, favor the non-smoker over the smoker. And that takes great courage in a lot of cities. And if they're willing to do it, we'll help them. And if they're not, you know, there are other things out there they can focus on to make their community healthier.
There's definitely those who would argue, I don't want to live a long life if it's not fulfilling or happy in any way. Luckily, you've discovered the key to happiness for us as well, right?
I just wrote another book called The Blue Zones of Happiness, which was the topic of a National Geographic article, wherein we took the same approach. We found the statistically happiest places in the world and then reverse engineered it. And you find that many of the same things that help you get to a healthy age 100 also make the journey pleasant. So they're almost like two peas in a pod, happiness and health.
So someone who doesn't have easy access to fresh vegetables and fruits, and maybe, you know, one of those social aspects, not a lot of friends, is there a solution on the individual level?
Knowing that one of the biggest drivers of your long-term health are your four or five immediate friends. If your three best friends are obese and unhealthy, there's a 150% chance that you'll be overweight yourself. So very selectively curating three or four friends who, number one, are vegetarian. Number two, their idea of recreation is hiking in the hills or gardening or biking. And number three, they'll care about you on a bad day. I would argue better than any pill or any supplement or any serum you'd rub on your face, that is the most powerful thing you can do for not only a long life, but a happy life.
I mean, like more than living long. Yeah, that's what I want. That's what I see humanity wanting, is the person who's going to be there when you need them.
So when I started this work in 1999, the average American had three good friends they could count on a bad day. We're now down to under two. So the world's going the wrong direction. You know, as we spend billions of dollars searching for ways to extend our lives and trillions of dollars on interventions to try to help make sick Americans less sick, we miss the point. And in these blue zones areas, it's so clear the things we should be doing to produce not only healthy, long-lived individuals, but also happier individuals. I'm hoping that this work will open some eyes.
Dan Buettner, National Geographic Fellow, New York Times bestseller of The Blue Zones, Lessons for Living Longer, from the people who've lived the longest. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
My pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in to Spotlight Health 2018, Episode 4, Healthy Communities. Tune in next week as we look into another Spotlight Health conference track, Disrupting Health Systems, from battling big tobacco in Africa to using empathy to create new medical systems. It's time for a shakeup in worldwide healthcare. To get caught up on episodes while you wait, go online, aspenpublicradio.org. I'm Allison Bektesh. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Spotlight Health, a partnership with the Aspen Ideas Festival and the Spotlight Health Conference. Join us Tuesdays at 3:30 for conversations with featured speakers from the 2018 festival. Hear from leaders in medical research, patient care, and others on the forefront of health. You can also listen to this series online at aspenpublicradio.org. The 2018 conference runs from June 21st through 24th and features five program tracks: The Cutting Edge of Medicine and Science, Healthy Communities, Disrupting Health Systems, Our Planet, Our Health, and Viewpoints. Spotlight Health is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.